You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Today's episode is sponsored by SRM, your first call for cybersecurity and investigations. Threats today are evolving faster than ever before, and since 2005, SRM has pioneered tailored security solutions for global corporations and their executives. Whether it's defending against cyber attacks with their award-winning team of ethical hackers and incident response specialists, or navigating the murky waters of compliance and ESG challenges, SRM's insight and straightforward advice will help you navigate complex risks and emerge more resilient. Their secret? A culture that nurtures the sharpest minds, giving them access to the newest technologies and the freedom to solve problems in new ways, enabling them to craft simple, effective solutions for your unique cyber challenges. Search Your First Call to discover how SRM can help your business. And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its zero-trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust Plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zero-trust-AI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast. From the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, the museum brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. Join us as we take a closer look at the secret world of intelligence. Today's Spycast is brought to you by our friends at Mack Weldon. Mack Weldon is reinventing men's basics. Smart design, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. Thank you for your continued support of SpyCast.
We're joined today by Nate Jones, who's the director of the Freedom of Information Act project for the National Security Archive. He oversees the thousands of Freedom of Information Act and mandatory classification review requests and appeals that the archive submits each year. A two-term member of the Federal FOIA Advisory Committee and board member of the American Society of Access Professionals, he acts as a liaison between archive analysts and agency FOIA offices, and serves as the Archive's FOIA counselor to the public. He's also editor of the Archive's blog, Unredacted, where he writes about newly declassified documents and FOIA policy. He's authored the Archive's past 8 government-wide FOIA audits. He earned his MA in Cold War History from the George Washington University here in D.C., where he used FOIA to write his thesis on the 1983 Abel Archer nuclear war scare. He's also produced the Abel Archer 83 sourcebook, the comprehensive declassified collection of documents on the 1983 nuclear war scare. His book, which is out now, is Abel Archer 83, The Secret History of the NATO Exercise That Almost Triggered Nuclear War. It examines the intersection of Cold War animosity, nuclear miscalculation, and government secrecy. Welcome, Nate. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at SpyCast.
My pleasure.
So I actually remember reading your master's thesis when it was posted in 2009, I believe. And I was very interested in it because it intersects with my research. I also remember thinking to myself, this would make a really great book. So my question is, what took you so long?
It actually wasn't what took me so long. It was what took the government so long to release the documents. Essentially, I started this way back as an undergrad. At that point, in memoirs and other books, there would be one sentence or one paragraph mentions of this thing that we'll talk about later called Abel Archer 83, the unknown nuclear catastrophe that affected President Reagan. And so I started writing, but there was no primary sources. It was all memoirs and things that you couldn't check out. So then I went to the archives, the presidential libraries, and started digging around. But I found out that where the information should be about Abel Archer 83, this war game, there was sheets that said withdrawn, restricted, you can't see it. So I remembered, I went to the archivist and essentially said, well, is there a way to get this declassified, or can I see it? I think we have the right to know. And he essentially kind of laughed at me. And that actually got me angry. And I started looking into how to get classified stuff declassified and learned about the Freedom of Information Act, and where the best place that had the best information about how to win your Freedom of Information Act, abbreviated FOIA fights, was the National Security Archive. So I got hired on as an intern there, and luckily they haven't got rid of me yet. But the irony is that if the place that I had filed this request initially would have just given me the dang documents, I would have got out of the business, done my research, and not helped file over 1,000 more every year.
They pissed off the wrong guy.
They
apparently.
Did. Yeah. And we'll talk about it, but the key document, just to loop back, actually took a 12-year fight. So the reason, real reason is why is the book out now is because we finally won its release.
Yeah, was it what, October of last year, of 2015, yep. They finally released this massive document that gave you really good insight into this period we're talking about.
Yeah, and so there's a story, there's a meta story. I don't know if we want to go, which route we want to go down first or at all.
So let me take a step back then, because one of the great things about this case, AILORCH 83 is not brand new. It's something, like you said, has been written about before in memoirs, been talked about by some of the participants. But really, the issue has been debated for over 2 decades. How important, how dangerous was this? Some have said, oh, it's nothing, it's just no big deal. Others have said, this is a really big, big issue. And your book really kind of sets to answer that question. But another thing on the FOIA access side, one thing that really tickled me, and because I've dealt with these situations before, most important document I thought I'd ever found, I turned a page and it's like next 75 pages redacted in full. And I wanted to set the archives on fire. So yeah, I didn't say that out loud, but
I know the feeling, and let the National Security Archive know and we'll file
absolutely.
MDR for you.
When you FOIA'd the NSA about AILORCH 83, they did something quite NSA-like. What did they do?
Yeah, that was one of the most insulting FOIA responses I've ever gotten. They took about over a year to respond, but their response was a letter saying, we've identified 82 documents, 81 are denied, the good ones that I still haven't gotten yet, and you can have one. And that was a printout of a Wikipedia article on AILORCH 83 that they had classified and then spent the time and money to review to unclassify this classified Wikipedia article. And the worst was I was one of the editors of the article. So I already helped know the stuff. So that was disappointing. But in the end, the documents tend to get out, and we've gotten over 2,000 documents to AILORCH 83. But the fight still goes on as well.
The great part, though, is now you have this Wikipedia document that you edited that has a classification stamp on it, which is just, it's so wonderfully typical for the U.S. government in this case. Well, for the listeners to understand this time period,
guess,
we do have...
Thomas Drake's probably laughing because according to some constructions, I could have been in possession of improperly classified information despite it being written before ever actually being retroactively classified.
Let's hope no one that matters is listening to this right now because we need you where you are. A lot of our listeners are not people who were alive in 1983. They may not remember this time period. They may not have taken a lot of this history in their coursework. Let's take a walk a little bit before 1983 and talk about some of the U.S. policy, because it began to change pretty dramatically. And unlike some of the rhetoric, it wasn't Reagan necessarily that began this change. It actually starts during the Carter administration, where the United States becomes much more confrontational with the Soviet Union.
Sure. So... I'll name two big catalysts. The first was the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, essentially ended detente, which was when the two superpowers between Nixon and Ford and Brezhnev had improved relations, signed a lot of treaties, essentially balanced out. But with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, think Rambo 3, ended that. And essentially began to ushered in what the best historian, I think, calls the era of renewed confrontation. The second is the nuclear issue, and that includes Presidential Directive 59, which came in the Carter administration and essentially provided a more aggressive nuclear posture for the U.S. with more options, including more early strike options. And that plays a role later in Abel Archer in the 1983 war scare. And check out the National Security Archives website for all the documents and
tons of the
on
documents.
That.
And that's a little response to the Soviet SS-20 scare, where they began to field what were called Euro missiles after the fact of these medium-range and intermediate-range ballistic missiles that could strike most of Europe within just minutes.
Yeah. So, essentially, there was, I'll oversimplify and say, nuclear parity. But the Soviet Union, like the U.S., had missile factories that wanted to build new missiles and missile engineers that wanted to get paid to build new missiles and their own industrial military complex, and they upgraded their missiles to the SS-20s. And later, later on, they, there's Politburo documents with Politburo members admitting that upgrading was a mistake. But by upgrading to these SS-20 missiles that essentially were better than NATO's missiles in Europe, the Soviets had a new nuclear advantage in Europe.
I just going to work. Reagan essentially took Carter's policies and kept them moving, expanded upon them somewhat. You know, he ran on the idea that the United States had declined during the Carter years. And whether or not that's true, Reagan took it to the next level. I mean, I think the largest peacetime military increase in history in the United States. And this combines with many of his advisors would be considered hardliners in many cases, people who were not willing to negotiate with
some
the Soviets.
Some of them are still around today, and they tell you with pride, yes, I am.
And so you almost look at, during the Eisenhower years, there was a policy that was abandoned very quickly known as rollback, the idea of not just containing communism, but actually pushing it back. And Reagan seems to have readopted that mentality.
Yes. But as I write, and I take a lot of this actually from the Soviet ambassador, Dobrynin. Absolutely yes, but there he was also at the same time that he was increasing the U.S. military buildup, adding dangerous new nukes, and the rhetoric, we can talk about that, not to mention the rhetoric. At the same time he was doing that, he also was a genuine nuclear abolitionist. So he really was working on two things, often at cross purposes, but no doubt he ramped up the Carter administration's animosity and buildup against the Soviet Union, especially with the placement that Carter had initiated, but Reagan finished and worked hard to finish it, and it was no easy feat to put these new Pershing II and Griffin cruise missiles in Europe, which also further altered the balance of power and could, by Soviet estimates, decapitate them within 10 minutes,
right.
They thought.
Let me talk to you about something that I think our listeners will find very interesting, and that's the imposition of psychological operations against the Soviet Union during the Reagan administration. This is something that doesn't get talked about enough.
Yeah.
It wasn't just rhetoric. It wasn't just increasing spending. He was actually really trying to mess with the heads of the Soviet leadership. And some of the stuff they did, which can be incredibly reckless today. Can you talk a little bit about the PSYOPs?
Well, yeah. So you can make the argument that some of the things that Russia is doing today with their buzzing of ships in the Baltic Sea, their flyovers over Estonia, actually is similar to what the U.S. was actually doing in 1983. I've read uses and misuses of history, and I don't want to go too far, but I just want to, the similarities are striking, although opposite sides are doing it. So in 1983, there are accounts of bombers flying right at Soviet radar and switching off as soon as they became in range, which that, more than anything else, or that contributed to the KL shootdown. There are huge naval demonstrations of essentially showing that NATO, or especially the U.S. Navy, could secretly essentially destroy the Soviet Union if they wanted to. Let's see here.
Well, I mean, you're looking at things that are the simulated air attacks, probing air defenses. Yes. I mean, these are things that you do in preparation for war. You know, this is seeing what you can get away with in many respects.
Right. Practice bombing runs over the Soviet Union's Pacific Islands on territory that they claimed was theirs. The more things change, the more they stay the same.
Well, I think what was interesting was it's not just it made them worried or made them worry that the United States was going to attack, but it did reveal Soviet vulnerabilities too. Because, like you said, there were times when the U.S. Navy was able to move from one point to the other and not be seen at all, including from Soviet satellites and Soviet intelligence. So this had to scare them a little bit as well.
They're vulnerable. Their radar, the U.S. learned, was not good. And a great corollary to my book is David Hoffman's Billion-Dollar Spy. And part of what he talks about is how they found out that the radar wasn't good.
Right, Adolf Tolkachev.
Billion-Dollar Spy. Yeah. And their satellites were failing one after another, so their early detection satellites did not work well. They were vulnerable. And Andropov actually ordered he got tired of these penetrations and, according to the CIA source, cited in the book, ordered a shoot-to-kill order for all planes that may be penetrating.
Yeah. 1983 was a pivotal year in the history of the Cold War, and some would argue, and there's somebody sitting in front of you that would argue, that it's potentially more dangerous for civilization than 1962. But it's important to understand what happened that year, specifically leading up to Able Arch 83, in order to fully appreciate the magnitude of that situation. Like you mentioned, the end of détente, which means we're no longer trying to live peacefully. Reagan's rhetoric, this is the year he says the Soviet Union is the evil empire. He talks about the Soviet Union should be on the ash heap of history. Yes, it's just talk. But Reagan was somebody that looked like he was kind of standing up for his talk. There was also, and I want to ask you about this and the impact of this, Reagan's announcement of a new program called the Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI, or popularly known as Star Wars. How did this have the potential of changing the balance of power?
Well, essentially, the Soviet Union, I think the historical evidence shows, could not do another spiral of the arms race. They had essentially kept up with the United States until 1983, but if the arms race were to go to space, which they viewed Star Wars as, they did not view it as Reagan, I think, genuinely did altruistically view it as he said at Reykjavik that he would share the technology, and the Soviets didn't take him up on it, maybe didn't believe it, but they essentially thought that it was, to use the Andropov quote, taking the arms race into space. And they feared, one, that they couldn't afford doing that themselves, their satellites barely worked, and two, that it would make all of the anti-ballistic missile treaties and other things moot and make them vulnerable. So the mutually assured destruction that they had kind of worked towards, and the idea of deterrence, they viewed SDI first and foremost as a chess move to trump this idea of deterrence that was the status quo.
Well, Matt is an interesting concept because you've already talked about this idea that the deployment or the planned deployment of the Pershing 2s and the Griffin cruise missiles into Europe basically throws Matt out the window as it is because of a concept during the Cold War that had developed about nuclear strategy called launch on warning. And this is something that dramatically changes the way people viewed the potential impact of nuclear weapons because you needed early detection and preemption in order to survive. Because now you're looking at minutes, not 30 minutes, not 2 hours. You're talking about 5 minutes if it's launched from Europe before you could decapitate the entire Soviet hierarchy. What this means, of course, is that you need top intelligence. You need correct intelligence. You need to know if someone's about to do this to you.
Right. So, essentially, the idea is that there may be some way to survive a nuclear attack. And that way is if when you learn the enemy is going to launch nuclear weapons at you, if you launch all of yours first before the enemy launches theirs. And it's scary to think about. Yeah. Today, I believe the president has made public the U.S.'s current nuclear policy, and what I believe that is also scary. It's launch under attack. So today, both sides will be destroyed, but will be destroyed slightly first and vice versa. A corollary to this is launch on warning, which was what both sides, especially the Soviets, were well aware of, and I have evidence in the book, was their nuclear strategy in 1983. And that is, when there is warning of attack, launch first with the hope of wiping out the other side and surviving yourself.
To get wonky.
So is mutually assured destruction.
Right. To get wonky, this is really counterforce strategy. The idea of, if you can knock out their missiles in the silos, knock out their submarines and their bombers, then you could protect yourself from a retaliatory strike.
Yeah.
But you need to do it first.
Yep. And to do it first, you needed to have intelligence that the other side was going to do it. And
you need to be good intelligence, right? I mean, so let's take a step back, because that's a great segue to talk about an operation that some of our listeners may have heard of, but others maybe have not. Operation Rion. This is the underpinning of this nuclear war scare. Can you walk us through Operation Rion?
Sure. So a lot of people see it spelled Operation Rion, but Ryan, R-Y-A-N, but it's Raketno Yadernaya Napadenya, and that essentially means nuclear missile attack. And sometimes there's a V in front of it, which means surprise. And this is a very large intelligence operation that the Soviet Union, under Andropov, before he was GENSEC, at the time he was head of the KGB, started in, I believe, April 1979. And this is corroborated from documents from the archives of Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, and most importantly, now East Germany. Now the German Stasi archives are open. And what this was a huge ramp up of human intelligence to detect Rion, a nuclear missile attack. So the Soviets tasked their intelligence forces and all of their Warsaw Pact allies to go and find and report on an upcoming nuclear attack from the enemy, which is startling. Most people that have written about this have said that, we lived in the West, and we didn't really think that they were going to launch a nuclear attack, but we reported it anyways, and it was essentially driven by Moscow driven by Moscow, and it didn't matter what the agents believed. It mattered what they reported. Oleg Gordievsky, a famous spy, coined this the intelligence cycle, where they report intelligence that their bosses tell them to report, and their bosses misuse it, and it just goes on forever, making things worse.
Because they weren't allowed to add an analysis to this. They basically just had to report the information as they saw it, and let people back in Moscow make the analysis decisions.
So the new documents that have come out have listed these 200 indicators. So some of them are the amount of blood in blood banks, or what religious leaders were doing. Was anything happening to the Constitution and Declaration of Independence in the U.S. archive?
Were they being moved?
Soviet spies were tasked to watch, and if they were moved, they were supposed to report back. And believe it or not, all of these indicators went into a computer, which in 1979 to 83 was a big deal. It's a bit bizarre to think about, but it was a dangerous and bizarre time.
Well, the foundation of all of this is that the Soviets, what we learn later on, is the Soviets truly believe that Ronald Reagan thought that a nuclear war could potentially be won, or that his leadership thought. There's the only way you do this is if you think there's a legitimate chance of nuclear war.
That Reagan was a different animal than any other politician, and it shows, I think, the impact that rhetoric can have on a situation. I think he clearly underestimated the impact his rhetoric had, and the Soviets were very scared by that. But the second point is that there is another argument, this was made by the U.S. intelligence community, that the Soviet Union knew that it was losing the Cold War. We talked about it couldn't do another merry-go-round on the arms race, and they thought that either they would eventually lose in the long race, or they could quit the race and perhaps go for it. And they portrayed this thinking on the West as well.
If you've been listening to SpyCast lately, you've heard me talk about Mack Weldon, perhaps even more than you'd hope to. The truth is, and the reason I'm continuing to talk about them, no matter what store-bought brands you've been using in the past, Mack Weldon is better than whatever you're wearing right now, and will be the most comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, hoodies, shorts, polos, and sweatpants that you'll ever own. As I've also mentioned before, the cool thing about this company is that they are constantly growing. If you went online to check out the Mack Weldon after hearing me first read about them a couple months ago and then never looked again, you'll be amazed at how much more they now have to offer. Things like their Vesper Polo, a perfect product for SpyCast fans. The Vesper Polo has a design inspired by James Bond. It has advanced fabrics and a collar that'll always keep its shape. This polo shirt is unlike any other. The Vesper Polo is even named after the company's favorite Bond girl from Casino Royale, Vesper Lynd. And as things are finally beginning to cool off a bit, there's nothing better than the Mack Weldon Ace hoodie and pant. Made for life beyond the 9-to-5, the Ace hoodie and pant was designed with a refined fit, super soft French terry, and details that go the extra mile. They were made to be worn everywhere. And then there are everyday socks that treat your feet right. Sharply designed and tech-enhanced, these stay put as you keep moving. A cushioned footbed makes for an undeniably comfortable wear, no matter how much pavement you're pounding. And for fans of the discreet, there are the no-show socks, which stay out of sight and slip-free with smart design and built-in gel strip technology. A seamless toe and extra cushioned footbed keep things comfortable, ideal for sneakers and for dress shoes. Of course, Mack Weldon will always have the try-on guarantee, hassle-free returns, and free shipping on orders over $50. Mack Weldon is reinventing men's basics, smart design, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. So go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off using the promo code SPYCAST. That's MackWeldon.com. Get 20% off using the promo code SPYCAST. So let's talk about 1983, because we're looking at, again, psychological profiles of what the Soviets thought. And I think it's important to understand that you didn't necessarily have the healthiest Soviet leadership at the time. The joke was that the Kremlin doubled as an old folks home in a funeral parlor. And Andropov, in 1983, who'd become general secretary after Brezhnev had died, and arguably Brezhnev for the last 5 years, or not longer, didn't even know who he was or where he was. So Andropov comes in, he's barely healthy himself. He basically spent 1983 in the hospital, leading from a hospital bed. How did this affect Soviet decision making? Because who's in charge at this point? You have somebody, I guess Andropov had massive, like many Russians, massive kidney failure and other things wrong with him. It's not like he could be level-headed and clear-headed all the time.
So the interesting part is that when Andropov assumed power, the U.S. Intelligence community, and I have a document in here, I think the briefing said that he had the best grasp on geopolitics since any leader since Lenin. And there were rumors that he liked to drink cognac and listen to jazz, and there were citations saying that since he had all the intelligence, he actually knew the true condition of the Soviet economy. So there was some initial optimism, but he falls ill immediately. And he did still rule from his hospital bedside, despite him not being at Politburo sessions. He had a grasp on power until about the end. But the center of power focused on him, Gromyko, and Ustinov in the Politburo. Someone told me that Gromyko, they thought, was the absolute guarantor of no nuclear war from the Soviets, because he, with all of his time in the West, knew, like the other agents, that it wasn't realistic that the U.S. would launch a bolt from the blue.
Right. You also mentioned KL-007. I think that, again, anyone who was alive during that time will certainly remember this. It was this major news story, but those who weren't may not understand. You can think about it today. If an airliner, you talk about these, you know, Malaysian airliners that get shot down by the Russians or the Ukrainians, whomever, that's problematic. But KL-007 had a sitting U.S. congressman on it. And the kind of crazy that would happen today, if that were the case, is what happened in 1983. I mean, this was something that really shook American politics.
Yeah, and While you should always read the footnotes of the book, I have, I think, a real revelation in the footnotes of this that I don't think is public knowledge, and it's from a declassified National Security Agency history. The reason that, according to the NSA's history, the reason that the Soviets shot down KL-007 was that they actually thought there was a genuine spy plane in the area. And there was. Yeah. And that was not disclosed, I think, essentially until now. And President Reagan and Secretary of State Shultz knew this and were briefed on it. And according to the NSA history, they chose to ramp up the fervor, as you say, and not disclose that the Soviets genuinely made a terrible mistake and that they were trying to shoot down a spy plane. But they did not mention its existence or that this spying in some way had contributed, contributed to this loss of life. And it was a huge incident. And really, that's what really set off the danger of the 1983 war scare. That was in September. Archer was in November.
Let's talk about something also that happened that year, that mistakes that could have possibly caused World War III, even not including Abel Archer. And that's someone who should be a household name as a hero, and that's Petrov, who, a relatively young junior officer, essentially working at the Soviet version of NORAD, who picks up an American nuclear strike and then does nothing about it, thankfully. Because if he had, probably would have been World War III. That's a story that came out relatively recently. A lot of people don't know a whole lot about it. What impact did this have on the Soviets' confidence in their ability to detect a real incoming attack?
Well, they knew that their satellites, they could not really rely on them. They knew that their radars, they could not really rely on. Griffin cruise missiles flew low enough and slow enough and could reach Moscow, but could not be detected by radar. So they knew that they were vulnerable. And this sense of vulnerability fed to Rian and the urge for human intelligence, and fed to the fear that they could be decapitated by a first strike by these brand new missiles that were just set to be installed in Western Europe.
You talk about indicators, that they're looking for indicators. And we'd also begun at this time to do things that actually looked like indicators. People might remember the fact that there was a Marine barracks bombing in Beirut in 1983. Well, the response to that was to dramatically heighten military security around the world, which is one of these indicators. And then the Grenada invasion had a really interesting side effect. That nothing, I mean, yes, they were concerned about us invading Grenada, which was at least a Cuban client state, but it had a very different and unintended consequence as well.
And I'll talk about that, but first we talked about, the past isn't past, if with the current Russian psyops and provocations against NATO forces. If you flip the script, the U.S. invasion of Grenada has many similarities to the Russian invasion or support of Syria. And I did a little thing on this on foreign policy. But when a country invades a country in its sphere of influence that it thinks should be under its control, sometimes they put in the little green men, and the U.S. does it too, including in Grenada. It also had the side effect of a huge increase in ciphered communications, probably that the Soviets couldn't read, that was in all likelihood reported communications between Great Britain and the United States, which was a defined Rian indicator, which in all likelihood would have been reported as something that could be misconstrued as evidence that a nuclear attack is about to occur on the Soviet Union.
And they may have thought that these were coordinating communications between the British and the Americans. In fact, they're the British and Americans yelling at each other, essentially, because they didn't agree with our invasion of Grenada.
Yes.
Which is, I guess, fun and ironic.
It was a sovereign territory of Great Britain. Yeah, I should say that.
In 2016, it's fun and ironic. In 1983, it was probably very terrifying. So let's talk about Abel Archer itself. This is not some small little war game. This is not some kind of brief, let's send a division into Poland. This was a massive war game that wasn't just by itself too. It's part of this broader thing that had happened throughout most of 1983 already.
Let's ramp up the weapons we're putting. let's put missiles that can hit Russia within 10 minutes. Let's put missiles that are undetectable. Oh, and by the way, let's make our war games way more realistic, too. So here's how the world ends, according to Able Archer 83. The Soviet Union has a death in leadership. Imagine that. Extremely realistic scenario. And the Politburo is in a mess. It tries to beef up its clients in the Middle East for oil, and it loses, losing money. Then Yugoslavia, one of its quasi-clients, accepts aid from the West, asks for military and financial aid from the West. And the Soviet Union, according to the scenario in Able Archer 83, thought that if Yugoslavia went to the West, which was a non-aligned country, but they feared that it would lose its Warsaw Pact buffer states or allies. So it invades Yugoslavia. Then, after that's essentially the first chess move that you can't come back from, it eventually invades Finland and Norway, and eventually a ground war in Europe begins. Next, the Soviets go through what has been long suspected. Soviets and their forces go through the Fulda Gap in East Germany, and NATO cannot stop them. Mm-hmm. So in this scenario, NATO requests to launch a nuclear signal against pre-selected fixed targets. So in Able Archer 83, U.S. launched the first nuke. And it doesn't say what target it was. Someone told me before that in the scenarios that he set in with Reagan, it was always Kyiv. And he told me that once he joked to Reagan, oh, okay, the Soviets are launching just one nuke back at us at Boston, but don't worry, it's just a signal. It shows how absurd it is.
Yeah.
But this nuclear signaling didn't work, and the NATO, during Able Archer 83, practiced requesting permission from the heads of state of all of the NATO countries to launch a full-on nuclear strike against Russia, and they did it. And according to the declassified documents, while they were doing this, they were moving NATO bases. They were taxing out airplanes with fake warheads. They were using new encryption for the communications. They were simulating a countdown to all the DEFCON levels, and it was a very realistic exercise. Of course,
I mean, shifting commands to nuclear war command headquarters and stuff like that too. That would be a huge indicator.
You have these Rion agents that had, even saying penetrated, I think is too much, that were watching and reporting back, even though they probably knew it was an exercise. And even if it was an exercise, military doctrine has the risk of masking or maskirova. And these reports fed Rion, and the Soviets were very startled. It was a very realistic, even if nothing came of it, it was a chillingly realistic nuclear release exercise.
This is exactly how it would be if it was a real attack. I mean, this is basically they're going through the exact steps they would go through if this was going to be the beginning of World War III.
On the one hand, it's good to be prepared.
Right.
On the other hand, there's evidence that earlier the U.S. bent over backwards to not provide confidence-building measures to the Soviets so that they could watch or let them know that it was just a drill to tamper down the tensions. In the high, terrible atmosphere during the Second Cold War in 1983, this likely did not happen.
Well, there are a lot of people that have argued. We talked about the debate that the last couple decades back and forth about how seriously the Soviets took this, because there are so many of these exercises. But this one really was not even remotely a routine. I mean, the radio silences, and you talk about the fact that they're talking open and the clear, which means unencrypted radio, and they're talking about nuclear strikes mm-hmm. in the clear and open. I mean, these aren't things that had happened before.
Right. Well, one declassified after-action report had a Air Force, I believe, lieutenant saying, I'm really worried that we were talking about, they called it slips of the tongue, of nuclear strikes or open radio, that could be misconstrued. So people knew. Mm-hmm. There was someone doing the relay slips of the messaging, and he said at first it was pretty difficult because you have to send so many slips, but then you start saying, order this unit to launch, order this unit to prepare for launch, and then you said that you start thinking, what if this is real? And then you start getting worried. Mm-hmm. And the danger was there.
Well, the Soviet reaction is almost as though they believe it was real. I mean, they don't just kind of sit back and watch this.
Right. So there's the point. The biggest point is that the reason that the Able Archer War Scare is the Able Archer War Scare is because the Soviet Union, in response, readied its nuclear forces in unprecedented fashion. And that's now documented by the evidence that was previously kept secret from the public. But the reason that Reagan called it really scary was because Soviet bombers in Poland and East Germany on the ground were ready. There were was an unprecedented amount of reconnaissance flights. According to one report, all other flights were grounded, probably so that those planes could be used for an attack if nuclear war actually happened. And the Soviets were ready to fight a nuclear war.
One thing that I always found the most chilling was that their top, the head of their nuclear weapons program, the head of their nuclear forces, was actually sent to a bunker outside of Moscow to essentially ride out the nuclear war. And the second thing for me is that we talk about the SS-20s. We had no idea where they were during that time. It's not like if the Soviets wanted to kick off a fight because of misconstruing what was going on, that we could take out their SS-20s. We had no idea where they were.
Right. And their submarines, for that matter. Yeah. And even if you do know where, even if the Dane, it's, you do not, even a 1 in 100 chance was what was said after the Cuban Missile Crisis, is far too high a chance when you're talking about all-out nuclear war.
There's another unheralded hero. We already talked about Petrov, and it's an American Air Force general. Mm-hmm. Lieutenant General, 3-star general, Leonard Perutz. Mm-hmm. What did he do that made this actually not turn into World War III?
He was also more than an Air Force general. He became a spy. He became the head of the DIA. Essentially, it's still murky because the official account of this, despite many key documents being declassified, the CIA still and DIA still have not declassified this to me despite my request. They're still pending. We're still fighting. But his full account is still officially a secret. But what we do know is that he, in the face of this huge Soviet escalation, he did nothing. So this is one of the cases where doing nothing was the right thing. So it's easy to imagine, with the Soviets essentially putting their forces on hair trigger, an Air Force general saying, well, we've got to match them. And you could see possibly the idea of launch on warning, Rion, preemption could have come into play. But according to the definitive summary, the best summary we have of this incident, Perutz decided not to do anything. Then, even perhaps more importantly, he, within internal chains, expressed his disquiet and danger that Able Archer 83 could have caused a nuclear war.
And this wasn't something, you said it was the right thing to do, but it wasn't the by-the-book thing to do. This wasn't, if he was going by what you should have done as a 3-star Air Force general, he should have reacted. And essentially he goes against his guidance, his training, and does nothing in that case.
And I think the quote is, either out of ignorance or out of luck, he did nothing.
Yeah.
And that's what the report says.
A lot of people who have listened to us understand some cognitive biases that we run into in doing intelligence work. And mirror imaging seems to be one of the most extraordinary ones here. And to me, one of the most frightening things about this is that even after this happened, we didn't take their concerns seriously. The CIA specifically, it was one of the real reasons that there is debate about this. They said, oh, it's no big deal. They never would have acted that way. They never would assume that we were going to launch. And this is really, it's about as textbook definition of mirror imaging as you can get.
Right. The key report, again, says that just because you know that your country will never cause World War III doesn't mean that the other side assumes that. So, definition, mirror imaging. And there is a real intelligence battle that, first there were two secret CIA reports that essentially said that despite all of these actions, there's no real danger. And then the other side wrote a memo to the president that said, well, actually, there was unprecedented Soviet reaction, and these reactions aren't blustering, and they have high military costs. So we think there may be danger, or enough danger, that we need to look at it. And Reagan saw this and was really scared. I argue in the book that it expedited the part of him that was a nuclear abolitionist, leading to Reykjavik. And then there's the historical battle and kind of the declassification battle. Mm-hmm. All of the CIA estimates that said that there was no danger were declassified very early. The estimates that said that there were danger were declassified a decade later. So it's a little bit of cooking the books. And again, there's still evidence and redactions hiding that it may be even more dangerous than we currently know.
And you make the cookbooking argument that, you know, the reason for that may be we still wanted to actually deploy these weapons to Europe. And if it looked like the deploying of those weapons were going to start World War III.
Well, and I think you can make the argument that there are a lot of pieces and a lot of political capital and a lot of money was made to make new Pershing 2 missiles and maybe missiles after that. And a lot of people, and you can make the argument that maybe they genuinely believe the only way to beat Soviets or Russians is has more, quicker, mm-hmm. quicker missiles. And if you do that, the fact that Abel Archer put the world unacceptably close to accidental nuclear war is not evidence you want in the public domain.
And you mentioned that Reagan at least took this seriously. Seems like a combination of this and what listeners have heard me say this before, perhaps, that the thing that turned me into who I am today was at 7 years old, my parents let me stay up later than I should have to watch a TV movie. The most watched TV movie in history called The Day After, and it screwed me up forever. And I study nuclear weapons because of it today. That seemed to have a profound impact, combined almost exactly timeline-wise with Abel Archer 83.
It did.
To change Reagan's perception altogether.
It did. And he watched a special screening before. The timeline is still slightly murky because some of the key documents are still classified, but mm-hmm. You can make the argument that he watched a special screening of that before he would have found out of this danger of Abel Archer. He wrote in his diary that the day after left me greatly depressed. One of the few times he was not optimistic mm-hmm. in his diary. And you know another movie he also saw? War Games.
Oh, yeah.
So he's a cinephile, and they had an effect on him, a big effect. He also talked about around the same time doing an actual, I believe the evidence shows that he kept putting it off, but he finally did the actual nuclear briefing when they say, Mr. President, put in these codes, and he puts in these codes, and they say, okay, Mr. President, the missiles have launched.
Well, learning about the PSYOP has to be incredibly, you know, humbling, or at least, you know, more. PSYOP is the single integrated operational plan, the push the button, as we use now, talking about, you know, politicians and the power they have. Essentially, it's the war plan to take out millions and millions and millions of people. And the briefing had to have been one of those things that someone like Reagan would have taken to heart.
Yeah. If you read his own writings and his diary, you can see that the risk of nuclear war, and he writes that it took me a long time to realize that the Soviets might actually think that we would hurl nuclear weapons at them. I had always thought that America was a force for good, and I thought the Soviets knew this, but if they have this twisted idea, writing after Abel Archer 83, mm-hmm. that the U.S. would, in fact, be a nuclear aggressor, I got to get a Soviet leader in the room with me and talk with him, is what he wrote.
Right. I guess it doesn't matter all that much what the Americans thought. It really matters what the Soviets thought, because they're the ones that would have reacted to this. And it seems like the Soviets took this much more seriously than at least the CIA was doing right after, because they seem to have reformed Rheon after Abel Archer 83 to at least... They knew how close they'd gotten. They wanted to make sure that there were better ways of reporting indicators.
There's evidence of this, primarily from the Stasi archives and some quotes from the man without a face, the great spy, Marcus Wolff, saying we had to make sure that what we're reporting was actually what was happening on the ground, not what people, and I think he meant the Soviets, believed was happening right on the ground. And there was other talks of reforming Rheon, though it can... Ironically, it did continue. It wouldn't be the first intelligence program to continue after it should be dead until 1989. And we have the actual Rian report, Rian nuclear missile attack, reporting on the actual destruction of these Pershing 2 missiles. Wow. Ironically, yeah.
So let me ask you,
which was negotiated between Reagan and Gorbachev and essentially wiped right. out the class of missiles.
The INF Treaty, right?
Yeah. Yes, that caused the danger during Able Archer 83.
So let me ask you, what's next? What other pieces still missing that you've mentioned this a little bit have to be classified? Are we going to look at a part two of this book in a couple years where there are things out there that you're trying to fight to get your hands on?
This is just the first step. I mean, there's still great books being written about the Cuban Missile Crisis. First of all, I hope to get more people, the Perutz, or that knew what Perutz was doing, to talk and cite some of the missileers and Able Archer mm-hmm. in the book. And there's more. The report of why exactly General Perutz was so concerned is still a secret. All of the information communications between the British and the United States, including this spy, Olav Gordievsky, who was probably the West's best human source mm-hmm. During Able Archer 83, the bulk of that is still classified. Anything having to do with NSA surveillance of the Soviet missiles and some references of a general alert we see the line, a Soviet general alert not seen since World War II, and then the rest is blanked out. Yeah. That's still classified. there's still a lot of stuff to fight to get out, no longer secret.
Well, this is a great first step for those who want to know about this incredible period in American history and world history that you may hear me argue, and I think it got us closer to complete annihilation than even 1962 did, just because of the amount of destructive power that both sides had. But that's for another day.
I got one last quote.
Bring it on.
According to the NSA history, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Soviets placed their forces on an extraordinarily high state of alert. But its offensive forces avoided assuming the highest, readiest stage, as if to ensure that Kennedy understood that the USSR would not launch first. That's the NSA during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Right. The part of the documents about Able Archer 83 that would explain that are still secret.
Yeah, they seem to stop right before that real qualifying phrase there at the very end.
We'd like to thank our great sponsor, Mack Weldon, for continuing to support SpyCast. Remember, you can get 20% off at MackWeldon.com by using the promo code SPYCAST. That's MackWeldon.com. Use the promo code SPYCAST and get 20% off today.
So I highly recommend this book. It's not just because I'm a nuclear wonk, because I think this really does open people's eyes to what, for many of us, was a moment during our lifetimes that could have ended our lifetimes. The author is Nate Jones. The book is Able Archer 83, The Secret History of the NATO Exercise That Almost Triggered Nuclear War. It is out now. I advise you to go get it. It's great. The cool thing about this book is that, yeah, you have what Nate has written, but he also has included these original documents. So you don't have to take his word for it. You can dive into these documents for yourself and see what all the hubbub is about. So, Nate, thank you so much for joining us on SpyCast. We appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot. That's fun.
Thank you for joining us on SpyCast. Every Tuesday, we'll give you the most interesting conversations with some of the most intriguing people in the world of intelligence. If you'd like to send us a comment or suggestion, you can email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Or tweet us at @intlspycast. That's intlspycast. The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit institution. To help support future educational programming, please visit spymuseum.org and click on our Donate Now link at the top of the page. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.